This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.
Welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service, or if you're listening on our website, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company this morning. And sorry, we just started with a song by Uncle Vic Sims from down Larpa way, actually. Nice to hear a bit from him this morning. Today, we're actually going to be discussing, I think, a very interesting issue. It's an issue we've been talking about a little bit on this program. It's sort of sparked by the ongoing controversy over this mega coal mine they're building on the Carmichael Basin around by Adani, this big Indian mining giant, Adani. But just recently there's been some updates in that, and we're going to talk to a land lawyer from the James Cook University, Kate Galloway, this morning. We have her on the line. Kate, how are you this morning?
Well, thanks, Amy. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. First of all, are you joining us from, you're based in Cairns, are you?
I am based in Cairns, and that's where I'm joining you from today.
Beautiful weather up there, I guess. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into land law?
Sure. Well, I graduated from university down in Brisbane and went into private practice, and the bulk of my practice was property law. I moved up to Cairns in 1992, and when we moved up here, my property law practice included acting for a few Aboriginal councils and Dogit areas and dealing with Aboriginal freehold. And back in those days also, the early vestiges of sort of native title legislation under the Queensland Native Title Act. It was exciting, but it wasn't really until 2004 that I started to learn a lot more about native title itself, and I worked for a couple of years at the Cape York Land Council. And that really opened my eyes to the real struggle that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples were engaged in terms of land rights. And importantly for my own personal and professional development, I realised that the struggle had been going on right from the beginning, and obviously what we see today, it's still going on.
Can I ask you just a question on behalf of our listeners? When we talk about land rights and native title, how do you sum up the differences? There's that common refrain, particularly from Gary Foley, you know, native title isn't land rights and land rights isn't native title. How would you describe the differences in a way that I guess people who don't really understand it would be able to understand?
Yeah, well, when I first came into it as a property lawyer with a Western concept of what property was, I saw native title as property rights, and that's really the way that the Anglo-Australian legal system tries to understand the connection that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have with the land. So they turn it into property. But land rights is human rights. So land rights goes way beyond the idea of a property interest, and I think that's where the Anglo-Australian legal system really struggles, because it's very difficult to turn those for our Western style system to turn those rights into a market based monetary value system. It's an entirely different system, and that to me would be the major conflict between them.
And I guess we're seeing that now in a lot of the debates around Aboriginal land rights and economic development, which I hope to talk to you more about. But first of all, I was really interested in an article you wrote on your blog. And for our listeners out there, Kate's got a really good blog, which we'll put up on our website. But it was around the enduring controversy over the Carmichael coal mine. And we've talked a bit about Adani, and particularly, I guess, for our mob, the sort of division it's driven amongst the native title claimant group, Wangan and Jagalingu. But just recently it was announced over the weekend actually, that Queensland's Coordinator General is actually proposing to extinguish native title over a pastoral lease to actually convert it to freehold, so to free up the ability of Adani to build an airport power station and accommodation. Now, that seems to be quite concerning. It could set a concerning precedent for Native Title, couldn't it, Kate?
Yes. So my understanding is that it's not the first time that government would have extinguished Native Title to facilitate some sort of infrastructure development. According to the press reports, the difference with this case is that it's one of the few occasions where government hadn't first secured the consent of the traditional owners. So that's what seems to be the controversial issue. And this is what, to my way of thinking, spills over then from a property rights kind of perspective into a human rights perspective. Because when you think about the UN Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, free, prior and informed consent is a hallmark of effective inclusion of stakeholders, of Indigenous people as stakeholders, not simply as people who have some kind of a property interest. So once you extinguish the Native Title without that consent, what you're looking at then is an entirely different process. So compensation will be payable under the relevant Queensland legislation, but the way that compensation is calculated and dealt with is based on that property framework rather than that much more holistic, integrated human rights framework of the prior informed consent.
Yeah, I guess it demonstrates that complete imbalance between what governments value, because I see it almost as we're going to extinguish Native Title, I guess, as a way to, you know, ease the, I guess, red tape, or to, you know, make it a lot easier for development to go ahead. We're just going to get rid of this roadblock, which just happens to be Aboriginal people who've been dispossessed of their land.
I think that's, that, to my way of thinking, that's the shame in this all. And at the moment, your listeners might be aware that the federal government has released a white paper on development across the north of Australia. Now, 76% of land in northern Australia is under some kind of Aboriginal title or claim. And one of the focus points in the white paper is to deal with what's considered to be the complexity of land tenure issues. And government is very keen to remove what they call red tape, so the complexity in land dealings. And when I think about this context that's uppermost, certainly, I think, in government's minds, and the Turnbull government has even appointed a minister for Northern Australia, Minister Josh Frydenberg, and I think about, this, what's happening or reported to be happening in the context of the Adani matter, I feel quite concerned that there doesn't seem to be a lot of explicit provision for the interests of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people based on their First Nations status, and I think that's quite concerning.
I guess it definitely does feed into that perception, I guess, what you're talking about before, the clash between property rights and human rights. I was just wondering, particularly with Adani, if this was actually, you know, the proposal actually did go through from the Court Adjutant General, I guess what sort of precedent would that set for other Native Title claimant groups around the country who are dealing with big mining companies?
It's really hard, I think, for traditional owner groups. I mean, obviously, you know, one of the mistakes that that outsiders can make is to think that there's only one voice within traditional owner groups, and we know that that's not the case, that people hold different sorts of views about things. But the concern is, I guess, that traditional owner groups will feel that they're not in a very strong bargaining position, and or that they're already sort of secondary position within the system is further eroded, so that they might not feel that they have a choice to be able to stand firm, because if they do, then there's always the potential that government will simply go ahead and disregard their rights. Now, one of the exciting things that happened earlier this year in relation to, or exciting for me as a lawyer, I guess, in relation to the Wangan and Jagalingu people, was that claims were made that they were going to challenge the Adani proposals or the mines based on human rights, rather than within what we presently see to be our native title framework. So that showed a lot of potential to me to be the next. It was kind of raising the bar of the whole issue of what we call native title.
So that's not something we commonly do we? We don't look at native title in that wider human rights framework as a whole across the country.
No, we don't. And let's remember also that the Mabo decision was based on, or at least partly was based on a number of issues, but the court certainly said that Australia can't ignore contemporary standards of human rights. And that was partly, or that informed the court's decision in Mabo. So human rights really is at the basis of native title, but we've managed to squeeze it into that that much more prosaic sort of property type of framework. Now, that can work. I know that there are traditional owners who have experienced a lot of joy and who have experienced really positive outcomes from native title processes, even though they take such a long time. But I think that if we're wanting to reduce complexity in land tenure issues, we should free up traditional owners to be recognised much more easily as the traditional owners of land and elevate their position as key stakeholders in the whole process.
It's very interesting you talk about property rights in this context, because as you mentioned before, there is that growing, and I guess it was something at the Native Title Conference recently in Port Douglas. I think it was one of the Human Rights Commissions, the Commissioner for Free Speech, I don't even know his full title, but Tim Wilson.
Yeah.
He actually is speaking about property rights as a dangerous idea, but there seems to be this, I guess from leaders in the land rights or native title bodies, almost what you see in the media is an overwhelming focus on property rights and changing and reforming the native title system to accommodate that. So it almost seems that that just seems to be the focus at the moment, the overwhelming focus. And we don't hear these other voices who might be looking at it, well, you know, we've got to take a step back and look at this human rights approach.
Yeah, I was really interested. The first time Tim Wilson came out to speak about property rights for Indigenous peoples in Australia, there's two ways it could go. One way is what I think is a really good way, which is to say we're no longer going to impose constraints on traditional owners from economic development on their traditional lands. Right, so that would be a good thing. We would permit the law could encompass all sorts of development ideas that would empower traditional owners to gain economic benefit from their land. That's really important. If we can use native title as a property right in that sense, that would be great. But what really concerns me is that the framework for thinking about property rights in Australia is what I'd describe as a very individualistic framework. And I can give you an example of how this is playing out in Queensland. So normally what we think of in the law as a property right or an expansive property right, one that we can make money out of, is one that we can trade. This is reflected in the white paper, which talks about secure and tradable titles. And in Queensland, there have recently been changes to the legislation for Aboriginal freehold and Torres Strait Islander freehold. Now, these are statutory titles. They're not native title, but they're titles that can only be held by Aboriginal people or Torres Strait Islander people. And the changes that have come in allow certain groups in certain named communities to be able to change this Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander freehold and convert it to what's called regular freehold. Now, this would, under the legislation, extinguish native title.
Yep.
It's been sold on the basis that it will promote economic development, because now people can sell their land and they can mortgage it and they can own their own home. But what hasn't really been explained is why native title needs to be extinguished to do this, and how people are actually going to monetize these freehold titles if there's not any market for their land.
You've actually spoke about it in the wider context of the way Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders have a lot of trouble even accessing a lot of the same structures as non-Indigenous people, isn't it? It's not the same to say we're going to free up land for home ownership when you talk about Aboriginal Australians, considering how much we're left out of in the wider society, I guess. It makes it harder.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I've looked at these submissions that were made to Parliament by a number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups and individuals, and there's the full spectrum again. It's not my place to say that that any particular group shouldn't consult with traditional owners, and perhaps they might choose to make that decision to extinguish native title. But what I did observe from those submissions is that some groups were saying, this is the best thing, bring it on. Yeah. And other groups were saying, this is a disaster for us, do not take away our native title. More importantly, going back to that point of property, the only way that government and industry seems to be able to understand making money from land is extinguishing native title. And that's why I want to have an open mind about the statements that Tim Wilson has said about property rights, because yes, if property rights means native title, and the law can facilitate traditional owners from economic development from their land, absolutely, we need to promote that. But why should government insist that to make money from land, native title has to be extinguished? That's what I find concerning.
And you've actually, one of your earlier articles talking about this conversion to freehold to make way for home ownership, you actually used the example of home ownership, and you talked about the fact that you don't have to actually do this. You don't have to actually extinguish native title to facilitate home ownership. So is it just the sake that governments don't want to do it? It's the easier way for governments to deal with it? Or I guess it's just this concerted effort to wind back whatever limited form of land rights we do have?
I think it's easy for government. Yes, I do. I think it's more challenging to come up with a creative solution to it. But for example, under earlier versions of Aboriginal freehold legislation in Queensland, you could mortgage an Aboriginal freehold lot, and now you can't. So that's a government choice.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be that way. The real issue in terms of raising capital from your land through a mortgage, for example, is whether banks will lend on it.
Yep.
Now, what are the barriers to banks lending on title? The first thing is whether there's a market for the land. A bank wants to know, if I can't recover the loan, can I sell up the land? Will someone buy it? Now, I just don't know that there's necessarily going to be a market for land in remote areas. And we see the volatile property market even in metropolitan areas, but remote areas are something, again, as you would probably know. And the next question is, can the borrower service the loan?
Yeah.
Now, I'm an educated white middle class woman with permanent employment, and banks like to get a guarantee from my husband when I apply for a loan. So it's lending is not blind to the social context of the person involved, and I just can't see any evidence in the arguments that government has put up, that there is a necessary link between a freehold title,
yep,
and truckloads of money showing up on your doorstep. I think we really need to think much more creatively about this.
I guess we've even seen it in just the evidence we've had around, I guess, 99-year leases scheme as well. I'm just thinking about the Tiwis when Mel Brough was trying to roll out his home ownership program, and in the end it was a very expensive program that ended up, you know, I think one house was built using that money, or one family was able to buy a house under that program. So it actually isn't based even on a lot of evidence at the moment, but the opposite, the side effect, the consequences are potentially huge for people who fought for, you know, decades, hundreds of years really, to get their land back.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm not in the front line of Indigenous affairs, but there's a couple of themes that I do see coming through. The first of which is that not all communities are the same. Yeah. Each community has its own aspirations and needs and so on. But the second thing is that government still hasn't understood that we need to listen to the ideas and aspirations of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So I think you still largely see policy that is being driven from Brisbane or Canberra or wherever, yep, that fails to engage appropriately with people on the ground. And I think this comes back to this notion of free and informed prior consent.
Yeah.
You know, for so long as we are ignoring the needs and aspirations and experiences of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the more we will continue to get it wrong. I was at a conference up here the other day about building homes or building houses in Aboriginal communities, and a man from Yarrabah spoke up and he said, we had this going on in our own community in the early 1970s. Yep. Government came in and pulled down all the houses and imposed their own plan, which didn't work. And here we still are. He said, we're ready. We know how to do this. We're ready to go, but we're being hampered because of the imposition of all of these other processes. And I mean, that's devastating to hear. It's also very affirming because we know that while some communities struggle with capacity in some respects, there are communities out there that have significant capacity, and somehow we're failing to harness that capacity to meet the needs for community development within those communities.
I really want to talk to you more in detail about the white paper for developing the North. But before that, I thought we'd quickly go for a song and a quick break. And I thought a really good song, I think we play it all the time anyway, from Little Things, Big Things Grow, probably the most iconic land rights song from Kev Carmody and Paul Kelly. So we're talking to Kate Galloway, who's a land lawyer up in James Cook University, and we'll be back very shortly.
From Little Things, Big Things Grow.
This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.
Hello, welcome back to Let's Talk. My guest this morning is Kate Galloway from James Cook University, who's a land lawyer, and we're actually discussing the issue around native title and land rights, and also the recently released earlier this year, the white paper for developing the North. And Kate, you talk about sort of this myth around autonomy and talking about land tenure, about promising economic growth and opportunity for autonomy, but it's in this very limited structure, isn't it? And I was just interested in that word autonomy. It's such a different word from what we're talking about, which is true self-determination. What do you mean by this autonomy myth when we talk about this discourse around land tenure?
One of the issues with these property rights, and this tends to be the sort of direction that Tim Wilson comes from, this sort of libertarian direction, is that particularly within liberalism, and liberalism is this idea that drives sort of Western democracies. It's the idea of freedom. it's the idea of each person as an individual and individual rights. And this is this idea behind individualism of land tenures and property that I was talking about earlier on. And very strong within this worldview is the idea that each of us should be an autonomous being. We're all responsible for our own welfare and our own well-being. And as individuals, we operate in this autonomous way. And part of the thrust, sort of that this conceptual worldview thrust in the government's Northern Development White Paper hinges on this idea of autonomy. So the government says, we as government are not going to invest huge sums in infrastructure projects, you know, like the Snowy Mountains scheme in times gone by. We're going to create the position for the market to be able to deal with this. And each individual or corporation within this market environment will be an autonomous player. And they themselves will invest and will generate wealth and economic growth across Northern Australia. And this feeds in with this idea of these individual titles, this sort of so-called regular freehold title in Queensland. So what the state is saying is that if you have a private individual interest, you can be autonomous. You don't need government to prop you up because you have the means at your disposal of generating wealth. Now, part of the problem that I've got with this idea is that it's founded on a falsehood. Yep. And if we look at land tenure itself and the idea of these individual titles, is that we originally got the land, government originally got the land by taking it without compensation from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So if you're looking at an economic equation as an input into the economy, land was free.
Yep.
for the colonizer at least.
God.
We didn't pay for it, right?
Yep.
Industry was built, particularly up here in the north, on the backs of labour by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and South Sea Islanders who weren't paid. So, and now we've got a position where we say, oh yes, we own the land and we've got all of these inputs for industry and now we're looking for this capital investment. But none of that was ever paid for by the coloniser. All of that cost has been borne by Indigenous Australians. So and
we're still paying for it in a way. If we're talking about what we're talking about now, we're paying for it in the limited land rights we have, but also the overwhelming focus and the push to actually extinguish that limited form of land rights. So it's still blackfellas ultimately paying this.
Well, I kind of see it as paying again.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh because it's just
no, it's
totally
ludicrous.
Not funny,
when you explain it that way, it really is amazing how, you know, people can't see this.
Yeah, so once you start to say, oh, the economy can only work once people are autonomous individuals using their inputs to generate wealth, I sort of think, well, but you didn't get those, you know, those inputs came for free. We've never actually reckoned the cost of those inputs into it. And we talk about getting rid of complexity, and I think that's somewhat insulting to traditional owners, to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people generally, because that complexity is just part of that cost that we need to come to terms with.
Yeah.
The other aspect about this autonomy myth and this individualism is that worldview, which is criticised in feminist discourse, it's criticised in other discourses, but that doesn't fit within the worldview of a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples,
where
there is this notion of communal title, where the people are connected with the country. It's not an ownership relationship. The land isn't an input. It's not a capital generating, profit maximising economic tool. It's actually part of the universe and it's part of self. And so, imposing this framework of of what some people call atomistic individualism. So yeah. Each of us is a little atom floating in the universe responsible for ourselves, actually is contrary to a lot of the cultural experience of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That's why I call it a myth.
And I would agree, because the overwhelming focus you're talking about, you know, wealth generation and accumulation. I mean, when Blackfellas talk about economic development and using your land as a tool for economic development, a lot of it has more to do with trying to lift a lot of mob out of disadvantage and fight for, I guess, equality. It's never about sort of that accumulation of wealth or capital, really. It's really about just trying to fix and heal communities. It's never about that. So even if you look at it that way, it's a completely different worldview. I mean,
that's
strikingly
right.
Different, yeah.
This is an observation that's been made by John Altman and Francis Markham down at the ANU, and they did a critique before the white paper came out of some of the work around this. And their observation of the earlier reports was that The general focus seemed to be on economic growth. So economic growth is just increasing, you know, GDP. It's just getting more money in the system. Whereas economic development, they point out, has quite a different connotation, because economic development can have, as part of its framework, the sorts of things you're talking about, lifting people out of disadvantage, generating or improving or supporting those connections within community, getting people back on country, and those sorts of social and cultural aspects that are so important. And it might not mean that you make, you know, super profits from what you're doing, but it allows you to live in a much more sustainable way. And this, I can see this idea coming through really strongly in the Northern Development White Paper, where there tends to be an emphasis, in my view, on economic growth rather than economic development, which has a lot more community connotation.
And you've mentioned, I mean, there's almost like an oversimplification. I mean, you've written about it before around the white paper and how they're actually going to do that. They talk about sort of getting rid of red tape and ensuring secure and tradable interests in land, and is the term that the white paper uses. But they don't actually put in a proper plan in place to do that, do they? So even in that sense, it seems to be very vague.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that, I think. One is it's a Commonwealth paper and the states are in charge of land tenure. So native title is a creature of Commonwealth statute, but other types of land tenure are within the purview of the states. Now, there is a common working group amongst the the premiers and chief ministers and the federal minister across Northern Australia, so Western Australia, Northern Territory, Queensland. But the white paper itself wasn't really in a position to develop Commonwealth government policy specifically in relation to land tenure, because it falls within these state jurisdictions. Now, at the same time that the white paper came out, the Australian Law Reform Commission issued a report on native title, and what it said was that it's really complex. Sometimes you need that complexity, for example, if it involves effective consultation with traditional owner groups, but some of the complexity is just, it just makes it too hard for claimants to be able to bring their claims, and it suggested that a lot of this needed to be rationalised, and that's a good thing. And I think the then Prime Minister Tony Abbott came out, when the white paper was released, and about the same time the Law Reform Commission report on native title, and he announced that all native title would be fixed up and determined by 2025. And I remember a few at the native title conference. I was up there too at Port Douglas, and everyone went, gee, if only we'd thought of that years ago, we could do it so quickly, why have we been dragging our feet all this time? So the big question is, how they're going to resolve those native title issues, whether they will just streamline the process for claimants to be able to have a successful determination and remove some of those terrible barriers that exist, or I guess, you know, in one sense you go, oh gosh, I hope they're not going to just extinguish it all on some sort of mass compensation thing, because that would be terrible. But well, I don't think they're going to do that, but we have to remember this background of the white paper.
Yeah, most definitely. And you've actually compared it, and I guess it's what we were talking exactly about before, but you've actually said it looks, this focus of the white paper and autonomy and the free market, it actually looks a lot like colonisation. So it's like we're in that second cycle of colonisation, and yet it's incredibly hard to talk about because it is so complex, isn't it? I mean, how would you describe that process?
Well, yes, it is, and I don't know. I think some of the traditional owner groups with whom I've worked over the years, or people that I've met, my observation is that these are really active communities. So you've got, I've taught students here, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, who they know a lot about the law and the legal system, because since they were babies, they've been going to meetings and they've been having consultations and they've been making claims and they've seen firsthand how a lot of these systems and processes work. And so there is a fair bit of capacity amongst groups, but that's also really tiring. I know from, you know, anyone who's sort of an activist in any area, you've got whole communities that are engaging in this frontline activism for years and years and years. And every new government that comes in imposes a new wave of regulation or comes up with a new process. And a lot of this, I think, is quite wearing for communities who are on the front line. And then the white paper's looking for all of this economic growth or economic development, and I guess people, I'd wonder how people on the ground actually feel about this. When you might say, well, am I just a pawn in someone's game, or how can we actually link in with this? There's two case studies, I guess, from where I sit. I don't mean to diminish any communities by calling them a case study, but there's two particular groups that I think we can look at for some lessons in how to interact with this system. And one is the Yolngu people up in the Northern Territory, who've developed a range of industries on their traditional lands. And the other would be the Wikinwikwaya people up in Arakoon, who have taken matters into their own hands in terms of developing industries that revolve around the needs and aspirations of the people for that country. And so they're two examples. There are many others, of course, and many diverse communities across the north. But how each community chooses to engage with this superstructure is going to be really important in finding out how communities can be self-determining, or whether this new wave of colonisation sort of washes over them.
And I guess, I guess people, and this, you're totally right, in different communities, because it's not just that. A lot of people are obviously dealing with a lot of different issues, and it's just like we can't trust government to actually do the right thing in this sense, because they're fundamentally looking at a completely different, in a different way, at where Aboriginal communities should actually be and what sort of tools they should be using to get there. I mean, fundamentally it's an assimilationist viewpoint on the part of government, I think, that isn't going to change anytime soon.
I think that's right. I think that assimilationist view is there, and there's a new imperative for government. The other side of this is to look at the white paper as potential for engaging. And so, for example, one of the observations that I'd make about the white paper is that it identifies the need to build capacity within Indigenous communities to deal with industry. And I think there was an example that said, you know, when big business rings up the community, they want to make sure that there's someone there who can take the call. And I mean, I had to laugh about this, but there's nothing in the white paper that suggests that industry needs to school itself in culturally competent behaviours to engage with Indigenous communities. Yeah. So this is this kind of framework where Indigenous Australians are people to whom things are done, yeah, rather than people who take agency within their own environment and have that capacity. And I think that we hear a lot of really strong voices from Indigenous communities, and we need to make space within this whole Northern Development Framework for these voices to come through very clearly. And I think we need not just to make that space, but for the rest of Australia to learn to listen to what people are saying and to respect those views and to respect the diversity of views that exist.
That's a really good way to end it. And also, I guess it brings it around to Adani and the current controversy over Adani and the fact that they have been, I think, it's been quite concerning how they've dealt with the Native Title claimant group around that. So I think that sums it up and brings it around really nicely. But I just wanted to close. I mean, where do you see this happening in regards to the story we began with at the start of the program in relation to the Coordinator General looking at proposing to extinguish Native Title? I mean, where do you think it's going to head next?
I don't know. I would think that it is my own perspective, but obviously maybe I'm biased. I think it would be a fraught decision of government to extinguish Native Title without the consent, the free, prior informed consent of the people concerned. When I think about all of these issues that we've been discussing, and if only there were a way to stop this recolonisation and this dispossession and to account for these land issues, I have to say that I keep coming back to the idea of a treaty. Yeah. And I think that would really be one way to give voice to all of these aspirations and to tie that together within some sort of a legal framework.
So it's about this unfinished business. At the heart of it, we really have to tackle as a country the original dispossession, the fact that it's never been dealt with before. And the best way to do that, would you think, is a treaty?
I'm a lawyer. So I like some kind of neat legal solution, and I would have thought that's a foundational type of legal solution that I could see. There's all sorts of social and cultural issues, there's attitudes, everything else needs to come from that. But in terms of shoring up the rights of for our first Australians, a treaty to me is a pretty solid foundation.
Thank you so much for your time this morning, Kate. We definitely have to get you on again in the near future, because I really enjoyed talking to you about this and it provides a really important context to what we're talking about. So I really appreciate your time this morning.
It's a pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
Thanks for that. That was Kate Galloway from the James Cook University talking about all the issues around the white paper for developing the North. And I think, it's one we will keep on talking about as we go, it's obviously an issue that isn't going to go away. We might just head to a short break and then I'll be seeing you tomorrow.
Our brain is at the centre of everything we do. It controls a wide range of functions, including how you move your body, receive sensory messages such as touch, sight or smell, use language and think. The brain needs oxygen and nutrients to work, which is supplied by a dense network of blood vessels. When a blood vessel becomes blocked or breaks, this causes a stroke. Depending on the blood vessel and the area of the brain affected, a stroke survivor's life is often changed. Here's Libby Dunstan, Executive Officer from Stroke Foundation Queensland, with some facts.
51,000 Australians suffer a new or a recurrent stroke every year. So that's 1,000 strokes a week or one stroke every 10 minutes. Stroke can affect every aspect of a person's life and also their families. So this can be from no longer being independent with the things that we usually take for granted, like getting dressed in the mornings and driving to work, through to talking with friends, doing the shopping and reading the newspaper. The stroke can impact on all factors of life in both physical and mental ways. Some people never regain their independence, and depression and anxiety affects almost two-thirds of stroke survivors. In many cases, people have ongoing medical requirements for the rest of their lives.
Every stroke is different. Each person affected by stroke will have different problems and different needs. The best medicine to help you get going after your stroke is the hope for recovery. You will notice improvements in what you can do for months, even years after your stroke. For support and advice, call StrokeLine to talk to a health professional for free information and advice on 1-800-STROKE 787 653.
A message from the Staying Strong Project, funded by the Australian Government Department of Health.
That's Let's Talk for this morning. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll be talking about a really interesting issue. We're looking at Islamophobia, but from an Aboriginal perspective, talking to Eugenia Flynn, who's a young Koori woman down in Victoria. I'm really looking forward to speaking to her tomorrow. We'll be back then. And until that, I hope you have a really good day. I hope you have a really good rest of your week and get over this beautiful Wednesday, stormy Wednesday here in Brisbane.